the Lord, the utterer, and the subjectivity. I cannot stress that point enough. We'll come back to it later today. I'll give you another mukkah for it. But I have to protest once again my Rebbeim, who said to me, you lock yourself in a vacuum chamber and you paskin the halacha. And that is so far from what halacha is all about. But then again, the litmashi yeshiva turned out lamdanim. They didn't turn out poskim and hadavai yadu. It's not for me to go into it now. I could give a two-hour lecture on that, but it's not for now. And the subjectivity, the maradiyatra, ultimately he has to bear the responsibility. And even if he is matir something that others were machmir, or he's machmir something others were matir, you have to give him the credit that he knows where he is and where he's at. And the example I gave you of my self-imposed gzeira of how to answer a young man in BMT when he asked me if a girl offers him a hand, take my word for it, don't beat me down on strictly halachic terms. But understand, as having taught in BMT for 20 years and having taught earlier in YU in America for 7 years, I know wherein I speak. Don't call me a machmir. Just call me a posek with understanding and common sense. Then we went into the whole question last week of gezeirot. And I showed you from start to finish, klal gadolam yubi Torah, that we are not mosiv gezeirot bizman hazeh. The Goyim say it, the Rishonim say it, and it's almost, if I can put it very simply, halavai we should be mekayim that which we have. It is already so difficult. There's so many demands in Yahadut. So halavai we should be mekayim that which we have, and don't ask for more chumrat. And that's the attitude. And I went right down the line. I showed you b'chol haTorah kula, whether it's talking about dinei nashim and katlanit, whether it's talking about rice on Pesach, which certainly is orachayim, it's not dinei nashim, it's moed. Whether it's talking about the Erev, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, whether it's talking about the bread with the meat, no matter what example you can give, all the Goyim and the Rishonim say, today we cannot be Goyzei Gezeirot. Now, the heart of today's shiur, and I think it's going to flow over to next week, one second, God. The heart of today's shiur, I'll come back to that topic, and I'm going to deal with it in great length, and throw out a special gift that I'm not going to finish today, but I'm going to throw it out because you're lamdanim and you deserve the best. And before the fact that you're lamdanim, you're yirei shemayim, which is more important. Now, and ein achinami, with the last part of the shiur last week when I reheard the tape, I was laughing because the very question that got asked was exactly what I was up to. Ein achinami. Yaakov, who's already been my Talmud for a good number of years, so Yaakov knows that I have a lot of difficulty halachically dealing with legumes on Pesach. I have to be honest, halachically speaking, the Pri Chadash is right. It does not make sense. It's not. There's no hint. It goes against open Gemara, and there's no hint of it in the Goyim. And suddenly, even in the early Rishonim, they say it doesn't make any sense. And then you see in Ashkenaz, we're meiser nefesh on kidneyot. I cannot justify it halachically. But this is one of the great differences between Ashkenazim and Sfatim. And even among the Ashkenazim, the Eit HaTzorech, we were matir. In other words, with all due respect, it's not something that we took upon ourselves that it becomes an Issa Gomor. And all of you know, there's a famous Chatam Sofer at a time of starvation in Europe, I believe during the Napoleonic Wars. So they were matir using kidneyot in the early 40s, in the mid-40s with the State of Israel and the War of Independence and Yerushalayim cut off. They were matir using kidneyot. Of course, they were machlit it, they boiled it first. There were halachic reasons why. But nevertheless, halacha lemaisa, there were times when we were matir. But I have to say, when I came in Aliyah, everyone here, without exception, used make kidneyot. When I came in Aliyah, you know, I was a big shot, and I called up the Chief Rabbi Unterman. I went right to the head, And I had a contact, you know, I can't exactly call a chief rabbi and expect to get an answer. But I had a contact, one of the people I worked with his nephew. So his nephew put me on, told him I was a Rosh Yeshiva in America, and at YU I'd come out. He was very gracious, so I asked him about Mei Kipniyot. So he said, I used it, Rabbi Cook used it. He said, this is Minig HaMakom. So I couldn't believe my ears. Then I went to the Shuk, and there was the old man, Margolius. This is from the Eid HaRedit, Salam Mazon. Those of you who are native Jerusalemites know it's the cheapest place in Jerusalem. So I yet knew the grandfather of the present owners. So the grandfather looked at me, oh, minutzdas avadam, minutzdas was denkte, minhotas, minhotas was essen, a dein Gott, minhotas, minhot the Shem and Kemet das Nutzen. You know, everyone uses this. What do you think? We have what to eat here. He's still living in the 40s. He told me everyone uses it. So I was Matineda because all the years in America I didn't use Mei Kipniyot. It was Italian, you know, the Rav. I don't know if you know. I don't have time now, but with Bartons, the Rav almost wound up in jail. You know, that's one of the. He got carried away to Drusha. And he said, how are you allowed to use corn syrup? We never use corn syrup in Lithuania. The Ashkenazim can't use corn syrup. And Bartons threatened a $50,000 lawsuit against him, you know, $50,000 in the early 50s. Think of what that's worth today. And Bartons was hysterical because the OU gave Hechsher to Bartons, and of course they used corn syrup. So I don't have to tell you what happened. The OU had a place in it, and Rabbi Soloveitchik's name, and that nothing that the Hechsher of Bartons is perfect. But then as time moved on in America, no one has to use corn syrup. Everyone uses cottonseed oil, etc. I'll be honest with you. I would go back to the Chumrah simply to be part of the crowd. But I only have one problem. I have a problem that my greatest joy on Yontif, on Pesach, is eating matzah with kalorina. That's a light form of margarine. And there's no calorie. I don't know why they don't make the margarine with cottonseed oil. If they would make it, there was a rumor last year they were going to make the margarine with cottonseed oil in Haifa, Rav Shaya Shavkon, and I was jumping for joy because today you can get ice cream and chocolate, you can get everything you want with no kidney in it. Kasha to everyone. No Mei Kipniyot, no kidney derivatives. But the big word went out, and suddenly there was an announcement that it was a mistake and they're not doing it, and my heart dropped. They do put out a margarine. It's a make-believe margarine. It's put out from dates, from trees, and they grind it up. But if you taste that margarine, I think if they gave you shoe paste, the shoe paste would taste better than that. So that's my problem. It's al simchas yontif. I have to be honest with you. Halachically, I have to weigh what gives me the greatest simchas yontif. I cannot be machmir if I was Martin Eder in 69 and Rabuntamin told me and I know this and that and I saw all the tshuva. But halach lemaisa, if anyone asks me, I always tell them, if you're here for a year or two, you have to be machmir. If you're here permanently, we can talk further. But don't follow what I do because I'm living here 25 years and I spoke with Rabuntamin and you're a Johnny come lately and you know everything today, everything is available outside of margarine. And maybe this year we'll have a yeshua that they'll talk and make with cottonseed oil. But I have to say, what God asked is correct, and I really have no answer. And those of you who saw Rav Zevin's article, or referred you to Rav Zevin's article, ain't hachinami. It remains a problem. And somehow, when it came to Kapniyot, the minig Yisrael was overwhelmingly strong. Again, I don't want to repeat last week's shiur. Perhaps the reason I gave you of the grain being blown by the wind is the most elegant concept. But then again, if you cook it before Pesach, you have no problem. Ribbono shel Olam, all the kalorina is made long before Pesach. They kasher out the plants in Israel like in February 1st already. Right now, they're kashering the major plants for Pesach. So it's made long before. So long before it's bottled, there's no problem with mashiko. I don't have an answer, God. I admit it's halachically a problem. But it's a chumrah. It goes against all the klalim. Thank God you're a svadi. You don't have to live with our problems. Okay, did I answer your question? Yeah, but how can you call it a gezeira if it doesn't exist at the time of the Goyim in the early Rishonim? That's the whole problem, that they call it a gezeira and calls it a gezeira. What kind of gezeira? When gezeira? Who made a gezeira? No one knows where the gezeira was made. Who is the authority? How can you make a gezeira? And like the Prichadish says, how can you make a gezeira after the Goyim period? And the Goyim already said you can't make a gezeira. All right. I don't have an answer. Rav Zevin's article is fascinating, but he also struggles. Why? You understand what I'm saying? No one can put their hand on it. Why? Why this gezeira? Why the legumes? Now, with peanuts, I have to tell you, when I came in Aliyah, I saw chabotnikim eating peanuts. I couldn't understand what's going on. It turns out that peanuts are not considered legumes by many botanists. And there are those who talk to use peanuts and peanut oil. And I remember in my youth that I used to hear that certain Hasidim used peanut oil. So it's not that when they use peanut oil, it's not that they're being mekil and mekatniyad. It's simply that they have a tradition that peanuts are not legumes. And there's something to be said for it. I don't want to put it down. It may very well be that kitniyot are not legumes. So that's it. If the OU makes kosher Pesach peanut oil, it's based upon that concept that peanuts are not made kitniyot. In Israel, they came out with many different oils. There's safflower oil, but I think Rabbi Lichtenstein is mekiel on mei chamniyot and safflower. But I know that the Eidah Haredit doesn't accept any of it, and the ones they don't accept it, so everyone follows the Eidah Haredit, so all these various oils, no, it's mekitniyot, mekitniyot, mekitniyot. Some of the oils are not mekitniyot, but nevertheless, they use only olive oil. The problem with olive oil, those of you that know olive oil, it leaves an aftertaste. See, when you use olive oil, it's not the same as using regular oil, so that becomes a problem, but you can manage. My wife in Pesach per se, we basically don't use any oil. You can manage. But I have the problem with the margarine. That's my sole problem. Okay, but anyway, halacha lemaisa, I'm not smart enough to come up and solve a problem that basically is insoluble. If it's a gezeira from the 1300s, then my very words are contradiction ab initio. How can you use the word gezeira when we talk about something from the 1300s? You follow me? And that problem I can't solve. I'm not any smarter than the Pre-Chadash, and I'm not any smarter than Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. I can give many theories, but I can't solve the problem. Now, I'm going to come back to this topic, but I want to go one step further. And here's a topic that I touched upon before, and I want to touch upon it again. When we talk about Psak Halacha, we also have to know to paskin over the telephone is extremely dangerous. Now, and here you have a very fascinating tshuva from Reb Menashe Klein. Now, again, I've said more than once that Reb Menashe Klein, I never spoke with the man, but from his writings, I feel a tremendous kinship to him. He's a tremendous lamdan, and he's not afraid to say what's on his mind. And I'm quoting now from the Mishnah Halachat, Chelek Zayin, Siman Kuf Lamed Dalet. And this is the Yug of a Rav. I told you a little bit about him. He was Eli Wiesel's boy, Hit Chavruta. He's in Borough Park. This is the Yug of a Rav. This is Rav. If I'm pronouncing it right, if anyone wants to correct me, my language may be debilitating, but at least if I'm corrected, I can do it properly the next week. But I believe it's pronounced the Yug of a Rav. Siman Kuf Lamed Dalet. And he has the question, are you allowed to paskin? Listen to this question. Maradam on the telephone. What a maradam. Imagine, those of you, maradam is very difficult. Basically, what are the colors that are no good? I mean, those of you that are married, have studied, you know, red and black. Red and black. But it's a very difficult because you have variations and other colors, and sometimes, who knows, you know, the woman tells you it's red. You look at it in daylight, then it's not red. Or the woman tells you it's a face. The woman tells you it's, for the sake of argument, a dark green. And you look at it in daylight, and you see that it's really to being red. So it's a difficult question. So some person calls Rav Klein or speaks with Rav Klein, and he wants to paskin. Women call him, describing it over the phone. So he says, Chas v'chalila, you cannot paskin over the phone. You have to see it with your own eyes, and you have to see it in proper light. And he says, Chas v'chalila, to listen to his words, Chas v'chalila, psok to kagonzal a telephone, b'yisa karet hachamur, v'noshim daitin talat. And that's the way he deals with that problem, the first part of this question. I want to tell you in parentheses that Tova Lichtenstein told me that the Rav always would get in his mailbox from women a bidikat wrapped up in plastic for him to paskin on. And I applied to the Rav, the Gemara, in the Brachot about David HaMelech, Chassid Anochi, that he's matir the woman, he has to deal with the Shilyan, the Shafir, you know, the most difficult questions, bloody questions, but to be matir Isha Labala, you have to deal with it. And the Tova told me that she remembers as a child how women would leave these Eidei B'dikot and with the telephone, and the Rav would get back to them. And it's a big mitzvah. And I regret, by the way, I never did shemesh. You have to do shemesh in this. I don't want to pass, and I always send them. I know who to send them to. But I say you have to do shemesh, because you have to see the colors. And they say Rabbi Tenla, I'm told that Rabbi Tenla has a chart. And in this chart he has all the different colors. And he says to the woman, what color on the chart did you see? And he paskins according to the chart, whatever she answers. And the truth of the matter is, that's what they did with Kiddush Chaydish. That's exactly right, that they had, what is it, Rabbi Gamliel had a tabla. They told Kazerita. Okay. But anyway, that's only the lead-in. And then he says, in general, he goes on, I'm very opposed to paskining on the telephone. And here it's exactly the words that we spoke about earlier. He says, look what happens. The Rav sits in his house. He's in the middle of conversation. He's concerned with the problem. Suddenly, the telephone calls, and people expect an answer on the spot. They don't give the Rav time to be mityashev, to get his mind clear, to look into Sfarim, he says. And nowadays, like if you say you have to look into Sfarim, he says, people look at you like you don't know how to learn. And he says, this is not true. How can you paskin without Yishuv Hadat? And Yishuv Hadat means looking into Sfarim. And he says, who can say, Zachiti libi shani baki b'chol ha-Torah, v'yachol la'shiv al kol shela b'alpeh, b'li shemi. And imagine a person goes around boasting, I can paskin any shayla. I'm a bucky in Rishonim and Achronim, and I can answer you on the spot. If that's what a person says, if that's the way a person speaks, oily, he says, if a person should ever talk like this. And he says, just the opposite. We live at a time that so many people say they're poskei halacha, and the truth of the matter is that very few of them know how to. And he says, Chas v'chalila, a person should not be ashamed to say, I have to check the Sfarim. And if you must paskin on the telephone, take the telephone number and be sure you know who asked the question, so you can always call back to correct yourself. And as I told you, inevitably, whenever I paskin through the telephone, I'm always wrong. I always have to call back. Most of the time. Yeah, I'm not talking easy questions or questions on Yom Tov Sheni. I don't want to frighten you. It's not that. But on a question that I don't usually get, my gut reactions, inevitably I have to call back. I have to change my mind. Sometimes I'm more machmir, sometimes I'm less machmir. I just got a shiloh with flowers. I had to call back. A few months ago, someone called me with Shemitah. So I was too machmir. My first reaction was to be too machmir, because if the flowers don't have reyach, we don't have to be machmir. There's no kedushat shviyat. I mean, bizman hazeh, when it's only the rabbanan at the most. But all this is immaterial. The last part, the last five lines, I go back to what I said 15 minutes ago. Am I mad at my rebbeim when I was a kid and I said, how do you paskin? And they said, you go into a vacuum. Go into a vacuum chamber. No outside influence. And here of this Rav, the Mishnah Halachir, a posek muvak says, listen to this. Gam ki shalim shela pe'el peh ro'im mihu ha-shoel v'yeich shalim shehabei pamim zekovei ahabei lepsok halacha lepsak halacha v'kol shekein le'inyan hefsed meruba. And that's exactly what we said 2 weeks ago. The subjective factor. How can you paskin over the telephone if the person is not standing in front of you? A great deal of psak deals with looking at the person. How do you know, hepsid maruba, all of your adaya? Imagine if, for the sake of argument, it's Charlie Bentheim asking the question. All right. Charlie Bentheim asking the question. You don't have to be overwhelmed if you have to be machmir. on a pot, on a pan. Imagine if it's some young couple that just came in Aliyah and they're struggling to buy an apartment and they have children that they're sending to school and they have to clothe them, and even though tuition here may be free, and get them textbooks and they're struggling. Believe me, let me not talk about others. There'd be a heck of a difference for the way with Paskin for Mr. Charles Bentheim, who's one of the giants of our generation, or the way with Paskin for Aaron Rakefet in the 70s. Okay? Understand me well. And this is exactly what the Mishnah Halacha says, the importance of looking in the person's eyes. And this takes me back to what I said, and you guys challenged me on last week, with all my dedication to Halacha, and with all my knowledge that Engels, Lingers, Eirat, and everything I taught you last week. Nevertheless, when a BMT boy asks me, Rebbe, if my girlfriend from Machon Gold, I tell her a good Devar Torah, and she sticks out her hand to give me a Yasher Kayach, am I allowed to take it, or do I embarrass her? My answer will be loud and clear, embarrass her. You understand? And believe me, it's exactly the word. And believe me, that's exactly what the Menashe Klein is saying, and that's a very important tshuva, halacha l'maisa, with insight and an understanding of the psak halacha. And for you who are learning your adaya, he stressed it, hefsit merubah. I would say 40% of your adaya is determined by hefsit merubah. Think of bus of a chalav, think of treifat, think of all these questions. And how can you paskin without looking at the person, without looking at the individual? Now I'll give you Rav Henkin, and this is now I'll give you the Makarn Rav Henkin again, and I'll show you something amazing from Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin again. You fellas are not going to, without me, without the Rebbe sitting behind the microphone, it's all lost on you, because times have changed. Rav Henkin, all of you know, when I was growing up, Rav Henkin, we stood in awe of Rav Henkin. All of America stood in awe of Rav Henkin. A little Jew, a white Russian Jew. Man, you know, he knew Masechet Eiruvin by heart. That was his favorite. He was the greatest bucking in the 20th century in Eiruvin. He knew Masechet Eiruvin by heart. For whatever the reasons why, you know, everyone, I don't know, I have a special interest, I don't know if you know or not, but when it comes to the marriage ceremony, I'm going to say shir for a year, 2 years, 3 years. There's no end to what I can say on a simple little marriage ceremony, which takes no more than 3 minutes to seal Jacob's faith. Faith, I should say. We have faith that his faith will be sealed. But that's what interests me. He was interested in Eiruvin. He knew all of Eiruvin by heart, the Posek Mufak, the Tzadik Yisod Olam, the whole world. A little man, Ezra's Torah. His whole life, I think he took a salary from Ezra's Torah, $3,600. Then they raised him to $4,200. He felt it was too much money. He only kept $200 extra, gave back. I mean, it's mind-boggling who this man was, Rabbi Yosef. I had the skut of knowing him, speaking and learning with him. Everyone stood in awe of Rav Moshe. I mean, even if Rav Moshe differed, but the awe was unbelievable. The Rav, I mean, everyone, Rav Henkin, was one of a kind. So, he published a wonderful volume, Eidet Yisrael, Halacha L'maaseh. It's about 120 pages. It's worth getting this volume. The problem is that it's not available in print today, but old rabbis, as libraries, lo aleinu, as the older generation moves on, any rabbi out of the 30s and 40s and 50s has this volume in his library, Eidet Yisrael. But he wouldn't publish it to make money, so instead he gave the volume to Ezra's Torah, where he was the mankal, and Ezra's Torah, published it, and they got all the proceeds. It's a wonderful volume, because it's psakim, very fascinating to see the way his mind works, what he tells you to do. By the way, not everything he's right, and I can't go into details now, but if you look into what he talks about children and benching, very interesting what he says, but I don't know whether from the point of view of chinuch, it's oisgehalten. He felt that they should do an abridged benching to be upside down right there. I don't know. You got to teach kids how to bench properly. And unfortunately, a kid at the age of 7 can only say Hazonatol, the first bracha is enough for him. He can't say more than that. You understand? Gradually you add to it, even though they're not judging anything, but they're learning how to bench. But anyway, very interesting. On page 167 in the Eidet Yisrael, he gives advice to Rabbanim, Herot L'Rabbanim, Mori Tzedek L'Kilot, And he says, the lo yafel seem those that call the rabbi, and he says, and the worst part is that they call him, and many times they don't give their name. And he says, you know why they do it now? By the way, I've gotten questions where they don't give their name, but I understand why. I've gotten terrible questions. We live in a world, I don't have to tell you. An adulteress calls me to Rifana Shalom. She's a big fan of mine. I don't know who the woman is until today, but you know, from up north, a big divide. I must have a lot of devotees. I have devotees running from Tzaddikim to Episcopalian priest with everything in the middle. Hashem Yerachem. But I've gotten calls, so obviously a woman like that is not going to give her name. You understand? Or they're having a terrible fight in the family, and they don't. That I understand. But he says, take call to ask the rabbi what to do on Purim. We have a tremendous Purim coming, the triple Purim. So why don't you give your name? He says they want to save the psak geld. Now you know what that means, the psak geld. This goes back to the way Rabbanim Lo Aleinu were supported in America in Orthodox shuls. There was no concept of having a rabbi with a salary. That was for reform, that was for conservative. A rav had a number of shuls, and he got paid for funerals, weddings, supervision, Hanukkah, Purim, they brought the rav in a gift, or they brought the rabbitson in a gift, and psak geld. And what psak geld means, when you went to a rav and asked him questions, so it was a nice gesture. Once a year, you gave him a gift, and it was called psak geld. Rebbe Yechvelach B'Tzolom Fayah Fa'ayah Psakim, if give the Rebbe Abyssal psak geld. That's what it was called. I sat in Dinei Torah when I was, many years ago, in the early 60s. So the Elter Rabbanim, the Din Torah would be finished, I walk away. Why I walk away? I'm getting a salary from my congregation. But there would be an Elter Rav, and he would say to the Balabatim, yet stuff to give him psak geld. Do you understand? Now you have to pay up. So he says that these people ask the Rav because they want to avoid paying the psak geld. In modern times, I can translate it very simply. When you know a rabbi, what do people say when they're cynical about rabbis? All that rabbis want is money. And this is true. I told you my going to Muncie, what happened on the Mechitza bus, what happened to me. It's a true story. If I didn't tell you, it's worth telling. I get on the bus, I'm going to Muncie, and I get on, I sit down next to this guy, and we have a whole conversation. I don't even tell you what it's about. I don't want you to identify him because it's embarrassing. And he evidently didn't know why I was going to Muncie. And he says to me, oh, every shner in the world and every rabbi comes to Muncie and every mishulach comes to Muncie and I'm sick and tired of it and they drive us crazy. And finally, I was so offended. I said, listen, I want you to know I'm coming to Muncie because I'm also a mishulach. I'm also a rabbi. I'm coming to speak for Shvut Ami. We have a parlor meeting, and I said, we rabbis could save the world. You don't give a damn about Judaism. You're happy. You put on tefillin every morning. You daven 3 times a day. You observe Shabbos. You don't give a damn outside of that. You're out there professional. You're making money. I said, you're looking at a Jew. Look at me. My whole life, from the time I'm 12 years old, I've had no other concern in my mind, and my life is an open book. There are people here who know me going back to when I was 7 years old. Barry can check it out. My life is an open book. From the time I was 12, I had only one concern, how to create Jews, how to create the Torah should survive. We have tremendous ideas. Where the heck are we going to get the money? Did I ever work a day in my life? Did I ever make a penny in my life? I said, all my life I'm teaching Torah, thinking Torah, living Torah, breathing Torah. The poor guy was in tears. He felt bad. But I felt, I have to say, he came to the parlor meeting and he left, I believe it was $1,000. And they told me, this guy never gives more than $500. So I said, listen, there are reasons why he left $1,000. Take my word for it, without going into details. But today, you understand, if you call, for the sake of argument, Rabbi Billet with your questions in Woodmere, and then Rabbi Billet has to raise funds for something going on in Israel, so we'll come to you. And he'll come in, and you feel awkward. I mean, after all, you've been calling Rabbi Billet with your questions for 5 years, and now he wants a few $1,000 for some project, and he knows you can give it. All right. But if you call Rabbi Billet anonymously, there's nobody for him to go to. And this is the psak geld, and I'm just interpreting it in contemporary times. And then he goes on, exactly what the Menashe Kotten says so many years later. He says, The worst part is when you answer on the telephone and you want to change your ruling, you don't know how to reach the person, and he says, I would asa rabbanim answering all together on the telephone. Hopefully answer it. But if you have no choice, be certain to take down the phone number or the address of the person who asked so that you can always get back to him. So this is another facet of paskening, halacha l'maisa, and we live with the telephone. Today we have the fax machine. It's just unbelievable what goes on. But at least with the fax machine, there's a phone number where to get back to them. There's a fax number how to get back to them. But it's unbelievable, and we have to move with it. Today there are computers and internet, and I open my mouth even this year, and someone can quote it and put it on the internet, and so many eyes look at it, and this is the world in which we live. But one thing is certain. Halacha l'maisa, there's nothing like looking at the eyes of the person asking you the question. Torah has to be given. The Gemara says, I believe the Gemara in Kritot, sit near the Rebbe, look at the Rebbe. V'haya einecha ra'at et morecha. Take a seat where you can see the Rebbe. And that's so important, particularly when it comes to paskening the shaila. And this is Rav Menashe HaKotan, this is Rav Henkin, and it's a lot of good common sense. Okay. But now I want to come back. Now I want to come back to the Eruv. Now, the question of Eruv, again, you were little kids at the time, but the truth of the matter is, in the early 80s, there was literally bloodshed in New York over the Brooklyn Eruv. Yaakov will tell you that in Toronto, there is still bloodshed until today. I went up to Toronto for 6 days I was there, and came Shabbos, and oh, what went on with the Eruv? Can you carry? Can't you carry? This Eruv is limited here. Can you walk up beyond the Eruv? And it turned out, when Shula was davening in Chevra Shas, there was one of the people who was machshir the Eruv, a medical doctor who's also a Rav and a big Talmud Chacham, and he told me about the Eruv. I didn't see any major problems, but nevertheless, all hell broke loose. Now, Eruv is a very involved topic, and I'll just say a few things to introduce it and sort of open your eyes. First of all, there's a basic question, what is Rishut HaRabim? And which way we answer this basic question affects all of Eruv. Meaning, if we take the viewpoint that we were taught as children, which is the viewpoint of Rashi and Tosfot, what is a Rishut HaRabim? It's an area where there are 600,000 people walking in the streets. Well, again, you have to ask a simple question. Everything has to be logical. An area where there are 600,000 people walking in the streets? Wait a minute. If I stand in New York and I look all the way to Los Angeles, believe me, I'm going to have more than 600,000 people walking in the streets. If I stand in Jerusalem and I look all the way to Amman, or all the way to Damascus, I mean, now we're looking, everyone's looking, Paris is going to be vacationing in Damascus, he's going to go skiing with Assad, believe me. So Assad is calling a rally, believe me, when Assad calls a rally for support, 2 million people come out, or they have 2 million graves already dug with a little reminder of where they're going to be. I lived in Russia. I know what used to go on in Russia. I saw it with my own eyes. The Communist Party calls for a little rally to come out against American intervention in Poland. Remember the early 80s that Russia was threatening to wipe Poland off the map and America was making sounds as if they're going to intervene? They call a little rally. Anyone who didn't attend doesn't have a place at work. You understand? You come back Monday, you went at the rally Sunday, forget it. The Communist Empire has no place for you. So, Ribbono Shel Olam, if I stand in Riga and I'm looking towards Moscow, believe me, there's 600,000 people out in the streets. So, it means 600,000 within Machne Yisrael. It has to be an area the size of Machne Yisrael at the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is Yud Beit Nil, Al Yud Beit Nil. 12 miles by 12 miles, whatever the meal is, but let's say approximately 12 by 12. And within that area, you have to have more than 600,000 people on the street. Okay, that's one viewpoint. And that's the viewpoint we were raised on, that's the viewpoint we teach children.
Then we come to the Rambam.
The Rambam has a chumrah. He holds wherever you have an opening in the street of more than tetzlein amah or more, that is a reshut harabim. A public way, a passageway, a street. Now, tetzlein amot, translated times 18 inches for the sake of argument, how much does it come out? No, give me the answer. Tetzlein amot, 16 times 18, what do we have here? 24. 24 inches, 24 feet, I should say. 24 feet? No, 24 feet, assuming that my math, assuming that we can say it's 18 inches, whatever it is, there's sheet that here and sheet that there. But simply speaking, on a popular level, all of you understand that a street, a walkway, a road, a tetzlein and amot is, let me put it this way, in any big city, it is impossible that you will not find a street of tetzlein amot. The minute you find a street like that, you have a reshut harabim. Now, what's the difference if it's a reshut harabim, the oraita, or not? The difference is very simple. If it's not a reshut harabim, the oraita, you can make an eruv using a tzuret hapetach. And all of you know what that is. You've all been up in the mountains, you knock up some wooden slats, and you put a wire overhead. That's a tzuret hapetach. If it's a reshut harabim, the oraita, a tzuret hapetach will not help. And there, the only way you can fence in the city is to literally fence it in with doors. Tzuret hapetach is not sufficient. You actually need a petach, perhaps in the full sense of the word. So I repeat. When it comes to Erev, there's a basic machloket. What do we call it? One thing is certain. If it's not a reshut harabim, the oraita, you can put up an Erev with tzuret hapetach. We have many kulot. Because basically you'll be dealing with rabbinic law. But when you're dealing with Torah law that you're not allowed to carry dalet amot and reshut harabim, you have a tremendous problem. And there you need a real petach. A real door. And what is a reshut harabim? And here's the tremendous machloket. Rov Rishonim learned like Rashi and Tosfot, you need 600,000, and I qualified it 600,000 within Yud Bet by Yud Bet. The Rambam, his shita, most noteworthy, Tetzayin Amot creates a reshut harabim the oraita. Among the Achronim, there was a tremendous machloket in the early part of the 19th century between the Kehilat Yaakov and the Beit Ephraim. The Beit Ephraim was, of course, was Polish, the Margolit family, and he held like Rashi and Tosfot. The Kehilat Yaakov, Reb Yaakov Kaliner, Reb Yaakov the Rav of Kalin, the Talmud Mufaker, Reb Chaim Voloshin, was machmir like the Rambam. And there was a tremendous machloket. According to the Beit Ephraim, we can be makil like Rashi and Tosfot, and it means in perhaps almost every place we can put up an Erev with Tzuret HaPetach and people can carry on Shabbat. The Kehilat Yaakov is machmir like the Rambam, and it means it's probably not feasible to put up an Erev in any big city. How can you enclose a city with actual doors, actual barriers, not just the Tzuret HaPetach? And that was the tremendous machloket. Those of you familiar with the Mishnah Berurah, no, you remember the Mishnah? So the Mishnah Berurah adds up Achronim, and he's noted, you know, it's good to be machmir like the Rambam, like the Mishkanot Yaakov. Okay. Now, when it comes to the Erev in Brooklyn, a tremendous problem develops. Without getting involved in the halachic points, which I hope to hit later today, there's a tremendous problem, a logical problem. Can anyone tell me what the problem is? Ask me a simple, do you know the history of Erev in New York? What's the history of Erev in New York? At the turn of the century, there was an attempt to put up an Erev on the east side.
the trains ran overhead then, what we called the L. You still see it, I believe, in parts of Brooklyn, maybe parts of the Bronx. But then there was a Third Avenue L. You could get on the Third Avenue L two blocks from my house and go right down to the east side, and people asked Shilas if they're allowed to pay in advance. There was a man there who collected from you. You would pay him in advance, and you'd go on Shabbos on Yom Tov to Davin on the east side of New York. These were Shilas asked la halacha. There were all types of rumors from Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan. I've always asked my students, people say that Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan was matir on Yom Tov on Simchas Torah, getting on the L in the Bronx, going down to the east side to Davin at your shtibbel and be mesameach, as long as you paid in advance. I have never found that shiva in writing. If anyone ever comes across anything like that, please let me know. From Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan, don't bring me from others. I know from others. I want from Yitzchok Hanan a litvish posek, not a sfatik posek. Never found it. But there were rumors like that when I was growing up. So the Third Avenue well was taken into the Erev. You have a train. It's at Sereta Petach. The Erev would be until the Third Avenue well, not beyond the Third Avenue well. There were big rabbanim on the east side. And an attempt was made, but it never really gained acceptance or got off the floor. Then, time marches on, and the miracle of America is starting to happen. And by the 1950s into the early 60s, you are having a rebirth of Torah. But there's a real problem. Shabbat. Who can walk around without a handkerchief? After all, we're not living in the ghetto anymore. It's no longer, what did I show you in the Shulchan Aruch or Chaim, I believe it's Sadi Zion, Sifbet, they blew their nose in their shirt sleeve. Ribbono Shel Olam. Today you can't blow your nose in your shirt sleeve, so you have to have a handkerchief. More than that, maybe the handkerchief you can leave in shul. Many shuls have boxes of tissues today. We can find a solution. But children, you want to wheel a baby carriage. You want to go out of the house. People are living in Manhattan in tremendous buildings. It's not suburbia where you have a backyard. You can take the kid into the backyard. You put up an area around your backyard. But this way, the woman can't go to shul. She wants to wheel the baby carriage. So, tremendous problems. Parents, children, food. Children have to bring food to the parents. How do you bring the food you can't carry? Pressure was building up. Let's find a solution. You have any idea what it was like? Sukkot in the Bronx, Shabbat, when you couldn't carry, how do you get your food to the sukkah? These were tremendous problems. And by now already there were great rabbanim in America. Some of the greatest rabbanim of the 20th century lived in America for many, many years. For instance, Rav Chaim Heller and Rav Menachem Kasha. And Rav Menachem Kasha spearheaded a drive to build an Erev for Manhattan. This was the late 50s, early 60s. Well, Big Machloket broke out. Can you make an Erev? Can't you make an Erev? But nobody said that if you want to make an Erev, you are an apikoros, you are a sinner, you are beyond the pale. So Machloket. Big Machloket. A Machloket that goes on until today. Now, I can tell you in parentheses, and this is very important, the Rav said this many times, the Rav never carried on Shabbat. No Erev is good enough for the Rav, for the simple reason that the Rav has to hold like the Rambam. He's a Voloshiner, he's a Briska. Rabbi Yaakov Kalina, it's a Talmud of his great-great-great-great-grandfather, a Chaim Voloshin. So the Rav never carried on Shabbat. Perhaps the only place the Rav could carry on Shabbat would be in the old city of Jerusalem. Could be in the old city of Jerusalem. There's mamish a wall around the entire city, and although there's a petach when you come in of much more than tetzayin amad, but it could be there. You literally have continuity in a wall, and maybe there can be zichgeben in etza. But outside of that, the Rav could never carry on Shabbat. Nevertheless, the Rav always told us, you know the famous story? In Chaslovich, the Rav made two kopecks. He would get 2 pennies a week. How would he get 2 pennies? His job was on Thursday to check the Erev. In return for checking the Erev, the city gave him 2 kopecks a week. So the Rav said, I checked the Erev, I pocketed the 2 kopecks, but I never carried on Shabbat. But notice, he didn't rip the Erev down. He didn't destroy the Erev. Those that want to be Samach, Bavakasha, they have an Erev. Now look what happened in America. Then the Jews are starting to move out and they're enjoying the good life. Now let's zero in on Muncie. A Jew in Muncie, Barry will tell you, has a beautiful home. He has beautiful cars. He has wonderful children. Many have swimming pools in their backyard. Some people in Muncie have outdoor pools and indoor pools. Ribbono shel Olam, they have the best of this world. Come Shabbos, they're going to torture themselves. Suddenly, there's an Erev in Muncie, and it has Reb Moshe's approval. Well, you have an Erev in Muncie? Hey, wait a minute. The Jews in Kew Garden Hills, lovely homes, lovely cars, lovely wives, lovely children, good lifestyle. They're not going to have an Erev? Suddenly in Kew Garden Hills, there's an Erev. It has Reb Moshe's approval. Hey, wait a minute. Forest Hills, Detroit. Now, one by one, communities in America start having a Reuven. Then, Brooklyn. And here we have a tremendous problem. When it came to Brooklyn, World War III broke out. Something that never happened before. In Manhattan, I understand that at the turn of the century, there were no soldiers to fight a war. The Rabbanim wanted to put up an Erev so that the people who are carrying anyway, it should be, they shouldn't have an Issa, you should help them avoid an Issa, at least they shall be lismoch, we'll find Shittat. There were no soldiers to fight. Who cared about Yiddishkeit in 1900 in the United States? Wait a minute. Manhattan had a big machloket. No one killed each other. Queens puts up a Reuven, no one kills each other. And by the way, including the Erev in Queens, is Queens Boulevard. Queens Boulevard. Come on. Take the Rambam Shita, and even we'll talk about the 600,000. How many people pass through Queens Boulevard daily? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
Boaz Mori, I don't see him. Nathan Goldberg is here. Gandishi Yisraeli Shik is here. Jason Nepel is here. Avram Goldman was here. Jacob Rosenthal is here. Jake Pasner was here. I don't know what they ran out. Damar, whatever it is. Mark Theta. I didn't see Mark. There he is. Mark is here. Shlomo Holman is here. Uri Cohn is here. Where's here? Is here? Where is he? What the? Avi Baumel. Didn't see Avi Baumel. Zev Itzkowitz. Now, is there anyone whose name, Yaakov, you're in the class this term? Yaakov Kermeyer? Yaakov Kermeyer. Morty Heckler. Okay. And Danny Mann, who doesn't need the credit, I gather. Okay. By the way, Danny, I mentioned just before class that I got a letter from America. There are some copies of Bernard Revel available at Feldheim. He discovered them in his warehouse in Spring Valley. If anyone wants to know how to get it, I have the information here, if anyone's interested. Danny Mann, say that he spoke with me after class last week, and he's a walking advertisement for my volume on Bernard Revel. And I admit, unfortunately, I will never equal that again. It's my magnum opus. I was young. I had tremendous ability then. I was halavai. My future scholarship should equal that. Halavai. Now, when it came to the Erev in Brooklyn, something terrible happened. And what happened was, those who ushered the Erev absolutely interdicted and put into chayrim those who put up the Erev. Even worse, those who ushered the Erev went and ripped the Erev down purposely, being machshil thousands of Jews who were carrying, thinking the Erev was up. They went and ripped it down. It's Unbelievable. Tremendous machloket. Hatred, enmity. Bitterness, causticness. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein was caught in a tremendous dilemma. Because when it came to the Erev in Manhattan, Rav Moshe didn't take any stand. And he said, let the Rabbanim do as they wish, he will not take a stand. There are great Rabbanim involved, and Rav Moshe says we can be samach on what they do, that it's proper. He didn't take a stand. When it came to the Queen's Erev, the Muncie Erev, other Erev in America, time and again, they cited Rav Moshe as being Machshir the Erev. When it came to the Brooklyn Erev, suddenly Rav Moshe was totally and completely against it. And those that fought the tremendous battle against the Matirim, part of the reasons they fought the battle was that we are fighting for Rav Moshe's covet. And it's unbelievable, but it's true, and it happened, and it's documented, and endless sfarim were written and have been written about the early 80s about the issue. I have to say that Rav Moshe now has come a long way, because when he gave his psak in the early 50s, when he paskened that AID was permissible, he was maledicted, he was interdicted, he was cursed out in every forum. And now, take a look, 30 years later, anyone challenging Rav Moshe's psak is being called an apikoros, etc. And, excuse me, they are artificial insemination donor. Rav Moshe, by the way, it's interesting, on Friday, let me just mention, lo aleinu, on Friday, I buried a colleague of mine, Rabbi Yaakov Pomerantz. I should say, let me dedicate the remainder of the shiur to his memory. Yaakov Pomerantz, young boy from the Bronx, served, I believe, in the Marines, became a Baal Tshuva when it wasn't fashionable, came to YU before there was a Jewish studies program, and became a musmach of the yeshiva, was a rabbi in the Bronx, came in Aliyah after we did. I can work here for Chuzat Yaakov, for RCA, for the institutions they run. I can tell you about the Rabbi Jay or Yaakov Pomerantz, Jerry, as we knew him. He didn't have a bad bone in his body. Didn't have a bad bone in his body. And at Tzaddik, stories that they had four children of their own. Could no longer have children. His wife was a little older. It's not exactly what I'm saying, but for medical reasons, they couldn't have more children. And his wife, who's a saint, such good people, was doing volunteer work in Ilan. And in Ilan, there was this little boy that clung to her. No parents, just dropped off, being raised in an orphanage, etc. And this little boy clung to her. And Jerry and Patty adopted that boy, raised the child as they were. As a matter of fact, I was asked if he should sit. I said, Shiva Kriya, just like all the other children, the only father and mother he ever had. And give you an idea of the quality of who these people were, what they went through. You talk about Yisurei Klita, everyone here who came in Aliyah can tell his own story of what they went through. When I look back, I fainted. I can't. What's the difference? 69, 70, difficult years. Nevertheless, and Yaakov can tell his stories, our stories are nothing. Jerry came in Aliyah, 1970, you sent your lift by boat. The boat suddenly at high sea is in trouble. The captain gives the order to throw four lifts off the boat. He's allowed, the captain, to save the boat. One of the lifts was Jerry's. Everything they had, their wedding pictures, their dishes, you can imagine, all your life possessions went into the water. No way you can replace it. Insurance is minimal. The Balabatan were nice. It was Balabatan from a shul in Castle Hill in the Bronx. Went and made a collection so he could buy furniture and cutlery again. And I can even go further. It's so tragic. He literally died on his Mizbeach HaTorah. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. He learned B'chavruta once a week. He learned B'chavruta outside his neighborhood. Once a week he learned in his neighborhood. He learned in Bayin Tvagan. But once a week, I know them all. They were all mismachim from the yeshiva in my time. As a matter of fact, one of them, his son, was a very dear student of mine here in the Kol for a number of years. Rabbis Reuben Greenspan and Jerry Pomerantz learned together once a week. You remember 2 winters ago, we had a terrible winter. So the Chavritas met, and they're meeting in Rehavia, and the snow began. And there's no way, he has to go back to buy it for Gan. The car won't start. It's all snow. You can't get a cab. Buses aren't running. You made a very bad mistake. And something that I would do myself, and so I say to my wife, it's so frightening. You decide to walk. I love to walk. You walk in the snow. Walking in the snow. I can remember in America that we used to walk in the snow and laugh, and it was a big thrill. And he walked in the snow, and evidently the exertion was too much. And right after that, he had a heart attack, and then he had a stroke, and he remained a vegetable for 2 years, lo aleinu. So, at the funeral, I met the person to whom Reb Moshe had written the original AID. He lives in Ramat Eshkol. He's an elder rabbi, Y.U. Musmach, Rabbi Yaakov Hamnik. And if you look into Reb Moshe, he writes to Reb Yaakov Hamnik that your wife got a question. Interestingly, the woman asked the Rebbetzin. She was ashamed. You know, it was a question. A woman can't have children. Her husband has no sperm count. But her doctor told her her fertility is perfect, and if he'll allow her to do AID, artificial insemination donor, she can be blessed with a child. Her husband approves, and she asked the Rebbetzin what to do, and Yaakov Homnik turned to Reb Moshe and asked Reb Moshe the name of his Rebbetzin, and Reb Moshe writes, to your honorable Rebbetzin, please tell your aunt. That's where the truth begins. It's beautiful to see. HaRabanit, HaKvodam, HaMechubedet. And they were both at the funeral. So I saw living history at the funeral Friday. And this was Reb Moshe was Mati. I don't want to go into details now, but this, I mean, you should know what I mean. AID is the most widely discussed topic of the 19th into the 20th century. There's no topic which must be written than AID. And Reb Moshe and Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach with the big Mati and with AID, as long as it's Shel Goyim, and in America, since the majority of Goyim, although there are many Jewish boys in medical school who I also understand in those days contributed to the sperm banks for money. As a matter of fact, one of them, believe it or not, is a very good friend of mine today, and he recalls his sins, and he told me when he was in medical school, he contributed to the sperm bank, he needed money. But since the robe is Akum, so it's Rov Acha Akum, so you can, Reb Moshe was mapped in America, there's no problem of brother and sister, this is the greatness of AID, Akum, because there'll never be a problem of brother and sister, because Tinuk Geshem Mitkayer, Tinuk Shinola Dami, the Goyim have no concept, the Alpi Torah, there's no relationship between them, so you never have to worry about brother and sister. Whereas if it's AID from a Jew, Chas V'Chalila, later years, a boy and girl can go out, no one knows that they're from the same father, the same sperms, as what happens in artificial insemination. The person who donates from the sperms, they can impregnate 20 women, 25 women from one donation. So Reb Moshe's fame is driven, was he hounded? Reb Shlomo Zalman had to take his phone out for years. He lived without a phone. And now, by the 1980s, the shoe was on the other foot. And Nebuch, because people dared to oppose Reb Moshe, all war broke out. Now, Reb Moshe obviously was in an uncomfortable position. Because how can you be matir? How can you be matir the Erev? In Manhattan, Bidiyavad, you don't take a standpoint. The Erev in Queens, in Forest Hills, in Kew Garden Hills, in Hillcrest, the Erev in Muncie, the Erev in Detroit, or the Erev in Seagate, all these Erevim are okay, Reb Moshe's Heksha, and suddenly in Brooklyn, you're Hareg, the Al Ya'avar. And this became the problem. Now, how do we get involved with the problem? Because one of the factors that everyone discussed was what I mentioned last week from Reb Zvi Pesach Frank. Gezeira. You build an Erev, children will not know it's forbidden to carry on Shabbat. And as I told you, my grandchildren, believe me, have no concept of not carrying Shabbat. 2 years ago during the storm with the snow and the Erev was knocked down, I think we had 2 weeks, Yaakov can correct me if I'm wrong, I think there were 2 weeks in a row when we had no Erev. It was such a chiddush for the kids. I had to explain to them, this is the way we lived, I grew up in America like this, this is the way Jews live when they don't have an Erev, and it was a big chiddush. So this was what they say you have to worry about. You're not going to have an Erev. Kids will not know what will happen if they move to a place without an Erev. Now, the truth of the matter is that Tzvi Pesach Frank is absolutely right. Ein gozrin gezerah bizman hazeh. That consideration makes absolutely no sense halachically. It also makes no sense historically. Can anyone tell me why? Because throughout history, there has always been an Erev. In modern times, Paris had an Erev. And the machshir of the Erev was Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky. In modern times, Warsaw had an Erev, with the biggest Rabbanim were machshir the Erev in Warsaw. So Ribbono Shel Olam, if they didn't worry in Paris, and they don't want to give out grades, but believe me, as bad as New York is, Paris was the capital of sin already 100 years ago. 110 years ago, the nudies fell from the ceiling in what do they call the Filet Berger. It's closed down already. So when I was growing up, that was the only place in the world, you know, like every wild kid, his dream was to get to Paris and see nude women jumping out of the ceiling. Whatever the heck that means today, you don't have to go to Paris. You just walk any street in New York. During the summer, you'll see nude women walking around. You have to go to Paris. Baruch Hashem, you can save yourself open up a Marfa Shabbos, Ribbono Shel Olam. You can save yourself the money of going to New York today. Ribbono Shel Olam, going to Paris, I mean, whatever it is. But if in Paris, they were matir and erev, and they weren't worried, Ribbono Shel Olam in New York City, with all due respects, I'm not a great fan of New York Orthodoxy, but New York was a lot more Orthodox in the 70s into the 80s than Paris was at the turn of the century. So Ribbono Shel Olam, this is not a factor. And Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank is absolutely and totally right. Now, let's go into some of Reb Moshe. Very fascinating material. I'm quoting from the Igrat Moshe, Chelik Vav, and I'm quoting Siman Pei Vav. And this tshuva is written in 1974. And you'll see, whatever I quote from Reb Moshe, time and again you will see the dialectical tension. Because for the Rambam Shita, every posek in the world has to agree it's a chumrah. Me'ika hadin we paskin like Rashi and Tosfot. You have to go the way kids were raised. And the first thing we were taught in kindergarten is a Rashuta Rabbim equals 600,000 people walking there. Number two, time and again, Rav Moshe has to struggle. How can you put up an Erev anywhere if in modern times you have these highways? And when you look at Queens Boulevard, for the sake of argument, Queens Boulevard is something like 12 lanes. It may even be more. There are 3 speed lanes. I think there are 3 local lanes. It's 12-lane highway. The amount of cars that pass on Queens Boulevard daily, the amount of people, forget about the people walking, the amount of people, Manhattan, downtown Manhattan, Ribbono Shel Olam, Fifth Avenue, forget about the tourists, thousands upon thousands of tourists, the people who work there, the people who shop there. Excuse me? Nothing to do with Saturday. 600,000 is a din. If at any time during the week you find 600,000 people, that doesn't have to do with Shabbos. Shabbos, the people have to be in their homes eating challah. Follow me? But 600,000, like in the Machne, like in the Midbar, the encampment, the people. Fine. Okay. 600,000, Manhattan is overwhelming. How many people come into the city? It's a magnet. It draws. It's the center of the world, Manhattan. Ain't clean a kite, Manhattan. Toronto, I don't know, but downtown Toronto, that street, I don't know. Come maybe, I don't know. I don't know. But a big city, Manhattan, sir. We'll see. Reb Moshe discusses it. So now this tshuva is to Peretz Steinberg. Now, does anyone know who Rabbi Peretz Steinberg is? Larry, was that your rabbi? In Kew Garden Hills, there are 2 major young Israels. One young Israel is Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. The other young Israel is the young Israel of Valley Stream. Am I right? That's what Queens Valley. And the rabbi there is Rabbi Peretz Steinberg, who was a Talmud Mubak of Reb Moshe Feinstein. He's a big London. He's a wonderful rabbi. Kew Garden Hills happens to be blessed with wonderful rabbis. Understand, Rabbi Schoenfeld, there's reasons why it became the Torah center of the world outside of Israel. So he writes to him that in Kew Garden Hills that you built an Erev, and he says, Reb Moshe writes that I'm very pleased that your Erev does not take in the highway. If you know the Kew Garden Hills Highway, what is the highway that goes there? It's the Long Island Expressway. What is that? The Long Island Expressway, the Van Wyck, Grand Central Parkway. The Erev does not take in the highways. The Erev is not continuous. In other words, if you want to walk from Kew Garden Hills to Kew Gardens, you cannot carry on Shabbat. Am I right? Correct me if I'm wrong, because I was only a guest there. But the Erev is not continuous. So there, Rav Moshe writes, I love, by the way, in future generations, they're going to go out of their minds. What does it mean? Rav Moshe puts in quotations, Hai Vei, Hei Yud Yud, Vav Vav Yud Yud. What does it mean? That's like us trying to figure out what the word Marufiya means in the Tshuvat HaRishonim. There are six different viewpoints on what Marufiya means. We don't speak the language anymore. So he says, Hanikra Haivein, and says also, I'm very pleased the Erev was built in a way that the chances of it being knocked down are very slight. Now, what does this mean? This is a real problem. How do you construct an Erev where 99% of the time it will not be knocked down? The Erev in Yerushalayim, if you look at the Erev, if you know what you can see there very clearly? On the highway going to Tel Aviv, turn to your right. On the right of the highway, you'll see the poles with the wire going over on top. Now that Erev is a very good Erev. You know why? Because the chances of it being knocked down are very small. No cars go there. No one's going to crash into it. It's kamat impossible. The only time it becomes a problem when there's a heavy snow and ice will form on the wires. And this I understand after the, trees and ice. And I understand after 92 they did something that the ice won't harm. They said they used a different material for the wire. I was reading the papers that there was a hit patchut that the new Erev that they put up after what happened in 92 is supposed to be better. Whether it is or isn't, I don't know, but that's what the Mo'atzah Hadat did. So that's a good Erev. What do you do with an Erev? It's interwoven with a highway where a car can crash, knock over a pole. So Rav Moshe says, I'm very happy the Erev you put up, there's little chance of anything damaging it. And he says, not only that, I'm very happy to hear you have a Mashkiach who checks the Erev every Erev Shabbat. Now, this is very important. You cannot depend upon a chazakah. The fact that the Erev was up a week ago is a week ago. And this is very important. And in every community where there's an Erev, it has to be checked. I know that most communities check on Fridays. I don't know, I think in Yerushalayim I'm told they check on Thursdays, which also I can understand why. If they have a problem, they have to have time to fix it. So Reb Moshe says, Hineni ro'eh b'zeh toelet gedolah, v'hatzalami nechshol b'shogeid u'b'meizet. And Rav Moshe says, I'm very proud of this Erev. I find it to be tremendous tolelet. Now, watch what happens. But what's troubling? Why did Rabbi Steinberg write to him? Because evidently people were saying to Rabbi Steinberg, how can you build an Erev in Queens if Rav Moshe did not come out in favor of the Erev in Manhattan? Why is Queens any better than Manhattan? And here you're building it, and you claim Rav Moshe approved it, and your Rebbe approved it, and you're so proud of it, and you're supporting it, and you're raising funds for it. And what happened? What's the matter with Manhattan? So Rav Moshe writes, Yeyenda McClell in New York. Interesting. When he writes New York, what does he mean by New York? Manhattan. It's like, it's an amazing thing. People in Brooklyn, in Queens, where are you going? I'm going into the city. What do you mean you're going into the city? Brooklyn isn't the city? Queens isn't a city, it's all part of the city of New York. But it's true. We all say, in Yerushalayim, I'm going into town. What do you mean you're going into town? I live, Rav Chaim Berlin, I live in the center of town. My street you can't park on already. I'm on the last The last half block, a half block beyond me is outside of the center of town. You can't park. Ribbono shel Olam, I'm going into town. But that's the way we talk. If Moshe says New York, he means Manhattan. And he says, Daina Daima Klala New York, Shaloha Yazer Biritzoneinu. We didn't approve. Veratzon Hagoyen Rebaran, which Rebaran does he mean? Rebaran Kotler. V'yod Gedolei Torah Megudet HaRabanim. Ki New York, Ir Gedola Miod. Avo Kew Garden Hills, Hik Panali in Yirmeilu. And therefore, we don't have the problems that we have Manhattan. The lechein hu tova gedola v'toelet l'shmirat Shabbat. V'ani omer sheyafeh asitem. Hineni yedidomo kiromod. Moshe Feinstein. Fascinating. Postop Steinberg, you did great. I'm with you. I approve. And don't let any of the critics make any comparison to New York. New York is a big city, has other problems. Queens is a small city. You avoided the highways. You don't have the problems of New York. And therefore, it's true in New York, I was not in favor. But here in Queens, I am in favor. Now, but then the Flatbush era comes on the scene. And you have to understand, there's one lesson I learned in life. Sadma di'ara chadhu. It's one world. And if you're going to have an Erev in Queens, why should the people in Flatbush and Borough Park be any different? I mean, once you're not there in Erev in Queens, why should the people in Flatbush be different? And now you know very well, no one will buy a home in a suburban community without an Erev. All the advertisements you see, Englewood and Teaneck and Fort Lee and Woodmere and Lawrence, every advertisement, Erev, Shul, Yeshiva, Mitzvah, Ribbono shel Olam, there's no way you can establish an Orthodox shul today in suburbia without having an Erev in your plans. Now, the Erev in Flatbush, Rav Moshe has a tremendous problem. Because here he is opposed, not just sort of indifferent or on the fence or neutral like he was with Manhattan. And here, the greatest rabbis of Flatbush come to see him. And I know their names. The names are here in the Tshuva. And they want to know what Reb Moshe's viewpoint is. Now, this is Simon Pesayin, and this Tshuva was written in 1978. It's just as the Brooklyn Erev is building up steam and becoming a major controversy. Who were the Rabbanim? Tell me. Who was the outstanding rabbi in Flatbush there for more than 50 years, lives a few blocks from here today? Very famous individual, Rabbi Zalman Shoffman. Okay? So, Rabbi Zalman Shoffman, and he was a rabbi who, do you know Rabbi Shoffman? The young Israel of Flatbush, lives a few blocks, lives near Chov Shimoni. But you have to know, Rabbi Shoffman was one of the few American rabbis that was held in awe by everybody. The man is a Lamdan and Yerushimayim and a Rav of a Kehila and the Hanagar and the way he conducted himself. There's one Rabbi Shoffman, Kol HaKavod. In addition, who else? I don't know where he is today, but a very wonderful, darling individual, Rabbi Yisrael Polayev. If you know the name Rabbi is, he was the son of Reb Moshe Aaron Polayev, who taught Torah at YU for 46 years, was a Rebbe at YU for 46 years. Rabbi Yisrael Polayev, Izzy Polayev, I don't know where he is today. Is he still in Flatbush? I don't know. Anyone study? I think he was teaching in a high school there. I don't know. Yeah. Where did he teach you? In Hefta. Does he teach you in Hefta today? Must be retired today. He's not a youngster anymore. So he was the other Rav. And then Rabbi Shraya. There's another rabbi in Flatbush, one of the leading YU Rabbanim. His children studied here in the Kollel and BMT. The Shraya family. So these three Rabbanim came to Reb Moshe and they asked Reb Moshe, why don't you support the Erev in Flatbush? And Reb Moshe said, I told them I didn't want to get involved because there are too many problems over whether Flatbush is a Reshut HaRabim. But now Reb Moshe writes that I hear that people have started a rumor that I permit this Erev. I must make it clear that I am opposed to this Erev. And then Rav Moshe gets involved. Why am I opposed? And Rav Moshe writes, we have to make a cheshbon. The Ika is like Tosfot and Rashi. 600,000. We don't have to be Choshesh Halacha L'maisa for the Shita HaRambam. He says, but we have to know, do you have 600,000 in the streets, or don't you have 600,000? And he says, it's true. Bizman Hazeh, most people live in homes, most people work in their homes, work in offices, work in their factories. They're not in the streets for most of the day. But there are certain hours, Rav Moshe says, that everyone is going to work, everyone is out in the street, and it may very well be that at that moment you have 600,000 people. And then he says, you need Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil, what I said an hour ago. How do you define 600,000? 600,000 people, if I begin with 600,000 here and I have to go to Damascus, I'll find 600,000. But you need Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil. And he says, we have to check how large Brooklyn really is. And he says, it could very well be that if you take Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil and figure out how many people live in that area, and you can reach a conclusion, perhaps a fourth or a fifth of them are out in the streets at certain times, and you talk about the people coming in from the other boroughs, he says, you may very well have a Rishut HaRavim D'Oraita. And he talks about Manhattan and Brooklyn. He says, we have tremendous homes. We have buildings that are so big that you can have tens and tens of families, hundreds and hundreds of people within one little area. He says, it's not like Yotzei Mitzrayim. It's not like the encampment in the Midbar, because there they lived in tents. The tents were stretched out. Until you hit 600,000, you had to have so many tents. But here he says, one big building after another, you may very well have 600,000 people in the street in a lot smaller area than Yud Bet Al Yud Bet. And he says, maybe you don't even need that the people have to be in the streets. Maybe he says that you count the people in their homes. Because in the Midbar, who did you count to get to the 600,000? You counted all the Jews. Where were the Jews? The Jews were in their tents. You see, you counted them in their tents. And Rabbi Shigat involved there with a whole question. Do you count them in the buildings? Maybe only in the tents, because the tents are on the ground floor. Maybe in a building that's much higher up, you don't count. Maybe you only count the first floor. But Rav Moshe says in Yud Bet by Yud Bet, where you have so many large buildings, and out of these buildings so many people go into the streets, and so many people come in from other boroughs, it may very well be a Rishut HaRavim D'Oraita. He says, as far as worrying about the people in the homes, because if you count the people in the homes, then you certainly have 600,000 people to begin with. He says, this is a svara. I don't see anyone who discussed it. I don't see anyone who mentioned it. So I don't want to be machmir through my svara. But even granting you only count the people in the streets, you may very well have 600,000. And he says, this is why I am not in favor of the Arab. And now that people have spread a rumor that I'm the Matia, Shehu b'yatsim neged masha katapti v'neged masha nisovekin ledina, huchrachti lichtov miftabzeh. I had no choice. I had to write this letter. I had to write my opinion. I had to let it be known that I oppose the Erev in Brooklyn. Simen Peichet, another tshuva to the Rabbanim in Brooklyn. And once again, Reb Moshe gets involved with Brooklyn. And look what he says, that I've been told that if you measure from Borough Park and Flatbush, Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil, you know what you're going to have within that square. Yeah, a square. Yud Beit by Yud Beit. You know what you're going to have within that square? You're going to have the east side of New York, and you're going to have Wall Street. He writes that Lahashvat Ribur Hu Bahachnasat Miksat Manhattan Shenichnasham East Side Shehu Gam Wall Street the City Hall Bahasviva Shehu Old Aza Millionim. And he says it could very well be, you see, when you move that square, it all depends where you move it. If I move the square from the point of view, let's say I move the square from Brooklyn going out to the suburbs, may very well be you won't have 600,000. If you go from Queens and put Yud Beit by Yud Beit, and you wind up with Woodmere and Lawrence and Oceanside and all these communities and Hewlett and all the from Jews, but with Bani Shalalem, how many people live in Lawrence? How many people live in Woodmere? Do you understand? You're not going to have 600,000 Jews. You're not going to have 600,000 people. Forget about you. You're not going to have 600,000 people. In Lawrence, you live on one plot of land, where in Brooklyn, you can have a building with 100 families on the plot of land that you live in Lawrence or you live in Woodmere. So what do you understand? It depends where you put that square. Reb Moshe says, I was told, I wonder who told him, I wonder who did the chishuv, whether his grandchildren did it, but if you take a square, Yud Beit by Yud Beit Mil, put it Borough Park, Flatbush, and all the way over, you wind up with Wall Street, the east side, City Hall, and you have millions of people in that square. However, no, one question. Is it certain that you can count them all? There's only one problem. What intervenes between Borough Park and the east side? The water. You have the Holland, what is that? The East River. And Reb Moshe says, I'm not certain, because after all, we have the river. And it could be that you can't be mitzarev this to Brooklyn because the water intervenes. But even with Brooklyn alone, Reb Moshe says, absolutely, 100%, within Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil, not moving the square to Manhattan, leaving it in Brooklyn, Reb Moshe says, I guarantee you, you have 600,000 Boken violin at a given moment every day. Think for a moment, Ocean Parkway, people rushing to work, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning. Just think, Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn, Queens Highway in Queens, Queens Boulevard in Queens, Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn. And Reb Moshe says, I'm chayshish, shehu reshut harabim deoraita. And if this is the case, the vadai ain letak an eruv medina. There's no way you can build an eruv, because there's no way in the world you can totally enclose 600,000 Yud Beit Mil by Yud Beit Mil, not with Sirata Pesach, but with real doors. And this is what Reb Moshe says, and that's why he is opposed to the Erev in Brooklyn. Queens was Matia, not in Brooklyn. One more tshuva, Simin Peitet, same volume. This is a much older tshuva, 1961, to probably the most illustrious Orthodox rabbi in New York City at the time. You have to understand that there were three rabbis vying for that title. Rabbis Goldstein, Lookstein, and Young. I don't want to give out grades. I knew all of them intimately. All three were my teachers. But there's no question that the man who had the greatest amount of dignity and acceptance in wide circles was Rabbi Dr. Leo Young of Jewish Center. As you know, his successor went on to become the president of Yeshiva University from that congregation. So here's a tshuva to Rabbi Young, Hanukkah 1961. And Rabbi Young evidently was a little upset by Reb Moshe's fact that he refused to be mata the Erev in Manhattan. So Reb Moshe writes to him that I cannot be mekil. He refers him to earlier tshuvot that he wrote. He says there are many shitot that would aser an Erev in Manhattan. The area is too large, too many people. However, Reb Moshe writes, kva amati, I cannot say that we have to stop those that are lenient. He says, if these great rabbis feel you can put up an Erev, I cannot stop them. I don't agree with them, but they're ra'u lahora'ah, and those that want to be samach on them can. Aval ani batzmi, eni yachol asaya b'zeh. B'yav sheyeh tikun legabi elu hamatatlim shem, u'motziyim reshitayachet l'shem shelo kedin, u'bahat. And those words of Reb Moshe are unbelievable, where he says very simply that all these people that are clamoring for the Erev and claiming, put up the Erev, you'll solve so many problems, you'll save so many people from doing a sin, people who are carrying anyway. The Rebbe says, yes, this is a tikkun gadol. But what about all those who don't carry and will start to carry now that they hear there's an Erev? And for these people, I cannot say that it is permissible. And but he ends off again, Avol Rabbanim Asforim Sheyesh L'Takein Nishayim L'Asot Kamo Shechem Sovrim. I will not interfere. I have to say that those that want to put up the Erev, if they think they can, they know what they're doing, they're great Rabbanim, Chas V'Chalila, I cannot interfere with them. Now, let me end off the class. I don't have to tell you, Rav Moshe's position is caught up in tremendous dialectical tension. Manhattan doesn't agree to the Erev. He's chayshish for many shitot, for Rishit HaRabim the Oraita. And nevertheless in Manhattan he says, I will not be mocha. They consider it a great tikkun. People will be able to carry, who are carrying anyway, it will be behetta. But I'm worried about those that will start to carry, and it will be Be'isa. But when it came to Brooklyn, Reb Moshe was so much more strident and so much more outraged. They said, I'm the mater, chas v'chalida, I'm not the mater, I totally oppose it, I should have been the oraita. And this dichotomy, this tension remains. Next week, I'll show you how Reb Moshe tries to deal with it, because evidently he was getting a lot of feedback, so he does try to explain his viewpoint where Manhattan is different. It's not overly convincing. And the facts remain, in the 50s into the 60s, Reb Moshe took a neutral position. In the 70s into the 80s, Reb Moshe was opposed. But next week, we're going to see the Mekilim, what they held with the Brooklyn Erev, and the tremendous explosion, and so many other issues come up that have nothing to do with Erev, but because of the cover of Reb Moshe. Now, I'll tell you one story that we can tell today. I couldn't tell it years ago, but two of the people are no longer alive. It's a fascinating story that captures this entire era. Who here is a Talmud of Rabbah branch people? Who studied with Rabbah? Okay, so you check now with your Rebbe, and let's see if he remembers this. Okay? I heard it word by word from him in the early 60s. You check if he remembers it. Let's see whose memory is better. Word by word. You check it out now. It's an amazing story, and this story says it all. It's a perfect ending. It's not an overture, but a perfect ending, a perfect finale to this class with all the heartache. As Rav Moshe says, you know, panim lakan, panim lakan. Rabbi Braunschweiger left, he graduated college and got smicha. He got married a little later to us. So for a while he was a navanad, and he became the rabbi in Stern College, if you can picture that. And he would be there on Shabbat, leading the davening in Stern College, etc. Occasionally, to give chizuk, Rabbi Belkin on a nice day would go for a walk and walk downtown from where he lived. He lived, I believe, in the 70s or the 60s, whatever it was, would walk to Stern College to daven, to give chizuk. So here's Rabbi Braunschweiger. Rabbi Belkin comes in. You have to remember, Rabbi Belkin was very close, bosom buddy with Rabbi Menachem Kasher, lived right near each other on the west side. And Rabbi Belkin comes in, and Abba notices he's carrying his handkerchief, whatever it was, he took something out carrying. It's already the era of Rabbi Kasher, we're going to talk next week, is the big machshir of the era of Manhattan. So Abba goes to the Rav, and he tells the Rav, what Rabbi Belkin says, what's going on here? So the Rav says to him, I don't understand what he's doing. He says, I know, he says, that Rabbi Kasher is matir, but I don't understand what he's doing. That's what he answered Rabbi Braunschweiger. And this goes back to the early 60s. But that's exactly the tension that you were caught up with. Rabbi Menachem Kasher was matir, was machshir b'yeira. We'll talk about it next week in Manhattan. And here, Rabbi Belkin is carrying whatever it was. I believe it was a handkerchief. You'll have to ask Abba. I'm sure he told me it was a handkerchief. And he went crying to the Rav. You know, he was, well, what's going on here? The area of Manhattan, what should he paskin? I mean, halacha l'maaseh, Rabbi Belkin's carrying. I can imagine every Stern College girl is going to want to carry too. And he goes to the Rav, and the Rav tells him, yes, I know that they're matirim, but he says, I don't understand that man, you know, how can he be summers, the Shita Tarambam, etc. And that's the tension, and that's the dilemma we find ourselves. So, gentlemen, to reiterate, the telephone, we handled Rav Menashe Cutten's words about the subjectivity, looking in the eyes, the shilas of Maradem over the phone, that is just amazing. And then we got involved with the Gezeirah and the fallout, the Manhattan, Brooklyn, Erev, the explosion, America. Today we struggled with Reb Moshe Feinstein. I don't say that we've made Reb Moshe crystal clear. I can't make Reb Moshe any clearer than he makes himself. And next week you'll see he struggles. And there's a dialectical tension here. But I think ultimately Manhattan may be different than Brooklyn. And we'll speak about that next week. Then next week, I'm going to explain the Brooklyn Heter, very fascinating Tzirah, Snifim, Psak Halacha, right before your eyes, and the tremendous controversy. As I said last week, I don't have to advertise my Tuesday class. Those that were here this past Tuesday, you got your money's worth for the $1,000 it cost you to hear the Rav talk about why he identifies with why you. A lot more is yet to come, but God should keep us in health and happiness, until we meet again. Thank you so much. Das v'danya.